We'll turn the recorder on. And just a couple of announcements to say at the beginning. First a reminder, May 11th and the next week is the deadline for comments on the current round of outstanding drafts. Our next meeting is scheduled for June 6th. Usual first Wednesday of the month. And, you know, after this round of comments comes in, the following week we'll send out the next batch of documents for your review. And expect it'll be accomplice liability, kidnapping, perhaps also a kind of a PFCOB kind of type offense will be ready to go out. Look for that in the next batch.
And you're thinking about when that'll be due? Comments on that?
July, some point. I know we get into like the end of July and August, it gets into no-go zone. So it'll probably, mid-late July. And then the next batch, as we kind of stage things, will include at least some, probably the kind of like, sex offenses. Not clear yet how we might carve that up, with the current first through fourth and misdemeanor. Anyway, there will be some sex offenses, we hope, ready to go at that point for review. Human trafficking and maybe a few of the forced prostitution ones, which are similar, raised, a lot of similar issues with kidnapping, right, in particular, and some of the other offenses, quite possibly a portion of the current disorderly conduct and or rioting, which, is subsection A, which kind of is more like, breach of peace type disorderly conduct, and then rioting. So that's the kind of next set of things that we're kind of looking at. So in particular, want to invite any, advance, preemptive, comments on directions to go with those offenses. We've started, some look at those, but not fully in earnest, so that's still very much in development. That's kind of the immediate workflow for the next, few months to just kind of project ahead. Any other kind of scheduling questions or thoughts, concerns on anything? If not,
one question: are we going to do the August meeting, August 1st?
Yes. So right now, I think we're keep that in mind. Now, again, I will say that I think the way things are kind of staggered. Hopefully, if either we have a lot of absences, we still have it, and we have a lot of absences, or we end up canceling a meeting just because hardly anybody's going to be here, it shouldn't cause too much trouble. We'll have a batch of kind of comments coming back in July. Those would be potentially, ready for discussion at that August meeting, but that's what would also get kicked back potentially to the first September meeting. Right now, please keep it on your calendars. Do let me know, though, if you're going to be away and won't be able to make it, and then we'll just gauge if there's a lot of folks. We may end up canceling it altogether. If it's, just one or two, we may hold it. Other thoughts or questions? All right. So on the agenda, I put on the agenda again any discussion of the kind of prior batch, you know, particularly assault, robbery, threats. We went through most of these pieces. Oh, sorry, I don't need to have my email up there.
Oh, I wasn't trying to read that. I was just looking at the glare, but no. I am interested in your email.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what's it. My impression was that we rushed through a number of pieces at the very end, particularly some that David raised. I think we touched on most everything, at least from the staff side, that we wanted to kind of talk about with regard to like the assault, robbery, threats grouping. But I just wanted to double check if there was anything more residual on that people wanted to raise. We can talk about that. Otherwise, if not, we'll move forward to the batch of things that are kind of out now for review. Solicitation, renunciation, homicide, child neglect, vulnerable adults. So anything kind of residual carryover that anybody wanted to raise in particular?
Can I ask, had we finished, I don't necessarily need to talk about it anymore, talking about the weapon stuff?
The
sort of per se...
Impact.
You know, how that sort of ends up being complicating it to have the per se with a catch-all. Did we?
Yes. I think we had some, you know...
Did we talk enough for you all to be convinced I'm right? That's really what I'm asking. That was a yes?
We,
okay, then we're good.
Right. We did have some discussion of this. And,
I almost said no.
Exactly. The transcript says, yes. No. We did discuss this some, and I think where we left it was there are some kind of highly unusual and unintuitive consequences that might happen from keeping the in fact in the way we do. The like, you know, oh, and they dropped the gun on your toe and, you know, and it caused some pain to my big toe, right? Versus pistol whipping versus shooting, you know, things that are more. So, and right. And, you know, as I recall, the PDS proposal was to change that to kind of a negligent standard. I don't think we had looked at that more since our last discussion with you. So I don't know that we have anything more to add on that front. But that was...
Okay.
Yes, I think...
Mostly, I just enjoyed watching you struggle with the diplomacy of that, but that's fine.
Yes. Thanks. great. Anything else from the residual matters? If not, we'll very quickly, before Laura comes up with something else here, move on forward. So the new batch of documents, again, this is still out for review. We don't have comments back. And the one thing I wanted to really highlight, we did these accompanying memoranda, advisory group memorandum 16, which corresponded to the solicitation renunciation, and the memorandum number 17, which corresponds to the homicide and abuse and neglect statutes. We flagged a number of issues in those advisory group memos, quite a few, particularly for homicide, that, you know, remain out there. So this was pages 4, 5, and 6. We don't need to go through them all. 4, 5, 6, and that was just on homicide. And then Partly on 6, 6, 7, 8 for abuse, neglect, and I just wanted to flag these, you know, things because, you know, look, there's a lot going on in these statutes for different reasons. Both are, you know, homicide contains common law offenses, right? You know, there's nothing there for manslaughter right now. None of these statutes, you know, the first degree is unchanged since 1901. There's just a lot of, you know, there's a lot of case, you know, these are just, there's a lot of pieces here. So I would maybe just say up front, our first draft is more tentative than it usually is with respect to, and obviously, given the obvious importance of the homicide statute. So we flagged a number of things in the memo for you to, you know, to particularly invite comment on, again, going forward. I would also say on child abuse and neglect, you know, these are not common law offenses, but they are very old, some of the drafting on some of this. And again, while there's been an increasing recognition about protection and duties for with respect to vulnerable adults, and you know, we have statutes on the books for this, it was never, I don't think, kind of addressed as a similar type of issue of duty, where one has a special duty to another and then violates that trust, right, with respect to vulnerable persons or to children. And so our big thrust, our main thrust on those offenses was to have a consistent, clearer approach. Again, there's a lot of old, very ambiguous language, particularly with respect to child abuse, that we would just want to kind of clarify and address, bring in the case law. So a lot of moving pieces on these statutes. Again, we tried to spell out a number of distinct issues that are, we know are iffy in this first draft. But yeah, so with that caveat, definitely, you know, if there's at this point things we can kind of explain further or you want to discuss about the first drafts, open that up. And I guess, you know, maybe start with solicitation renunciation. If there's anything on that in particular, yeah. So this is the first draft of Report 18.
We have a lot of stuff to say on homicide, not very much at this point on solicitation.
Okay.
Just anybody? Timing-wise.
Good. Well, if there's nothing on solicitation and renunciation, then we will, I think, just move on to homicide. Good.
Okay. Well, I will ask about renunciation, and that is the choice that you all made, that the crime has to actually have been prevented or thwarted when you say at page 47 of the report that there's a strong plurality of reformed jurisdictions that don't have quite such a strict requirement. And I'm curious if how that choice got made and whether it's like getting made up for and because of something you're doing with some other inchoate crime or whatever.
Sure. Yeah, and sorry, can you say the page number once more so I can pull it up?
It's 40, bottom of 47.
Bottom of 47.
47 to the top is just, of 48. It's just illegal trends.
Right. So it's the last sentence that starts at the, on 47, for, right. 47, most significant, is that a strong plurality, and then the rest of it's at the 48.
Yeah, so it's just a policy choice. There's, you know, the when it comes to culpability, people tend to conceptualize in terms of like intention, but also results matter, right? Which is why, so for example, when we punish criminal attempts, when a result doesn't occur, you know, people tend to feel pretty strongly that there's, you know, that it makes sense to punish them less seriously. So when you're looking at this unique situation of renunciation and you have someone that has, in fact, committed a crime, a general employee crime, but then engages in conduct afterwards, which negates that initial blameworthiness, the question is just whether the fact that a result does not occur, is that material, or does that in some way impact the overall blameworthiness assessment? So, for example, you know, there are strong arguments each way. It's a policy choice. So, for example, where two people conspire to do something, three people conspire to do something, but it may in fact be that, you know, solicitation is probably even a better example. So one person solicits another person to engage in a crime.
Two people.
Yeah, right. Sorry, you want to talk about three people?
Yeah,
okay,
I do.
Fine. But
because I'm about to pull out.
What's that?
I'm like, hey guys, let's go rob a bank.
Right. So you say, rob a bank.
Right.
Sorry, Michael, you want to go ahead?
Michael and Janu, let's take Richard's computer.
Right.
Right.
Great idea. We agree that we will go take Richard's computer.
Right.
But then eventually I'm like, what the? That was crazy.
Right.
That's terrible. That's immoral. We're going to hell. I'm not,
right.
You know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
We have no chance of winning.
Right.
But you guys go on with it.
Right.
Even if I'm like, you guys, this is bad, so you should stop.
Right.
It seems like that should be enough. Even
to
if you
wholly
guys...
negate, to wholly negate
right.
the
right.
person. The
As
initial...
opposed to I have to, like, stand there and keep you from doing it. I have to call Richard. I
right.
have to, like, that just seems...
So that's
why I wanted the two, because I think it's more likely that you guys are like, actually, that was a fantastic idea. Let's go forward.
Right. Okay. So let me give you, but I'll give you
okay,
another.
You want your example. Okay.
Yeah. No. By the way, I'm not saying that. I think it's a hard decision, but there are examples on both sides, right?
Okay.
So, for example, I approach two other people and say, "Hey, we'll go commit this crime." These two other people weren't originally disposed to do it, but because I came up and persuaded them to do it, so in a sense, I'm the but-for cause of their criminality in the situation, okay? Then I decide after the fact that I want out, but at this point, they've already, I've lost contact with them, like they're already in the course of carrying it out, so I go to police to let them know about the situation, and then the police are unable to prevent it, right? So, in that situation, it seems like the mere fact, the fact that there was a lack of prevention matters, right? Or no, would you say it wouldn't?
I don't know. I mean, those other two people aren't less culpable because it was your idea. In the end, they're responsible for their own actions, right? They're
sure.
going to get prosecuted, they're going
That's
to
right.
get punished, and they're not going to be like, you know, I am not the one who thought of this.
Right.
So why then do you have to keep being responsible for the fact that someone else goes through with it just because it was initially your idea when you, in the end, it's
right.
not like you're like, hey, why don't you guys go do this? You're like, let's all of us go do
right.
it.
Right. Yeah.
And then when you're like, I'm not doing this, why then are you on the hook for having suggested it? For, you know, I mean, there may be some level of, I mean, it doesn't matter. I won't fight it. We're going to make our comments. I was just sort of curious if I could be persuaded
right.
Of the policy choice, or if you were like, yes, on this, but it's because over here with, you know, right, because I actually now read this a while ago, that there was a difference between renunciation and... like withdrawal from a conspiracy.
Right.
So I didn't know if you were going to be like, it's going to be different withdrawal from a conspiracy, but here's why this should be this way. That's why
yeah.
I was asking.
Oh,
not,
right, yeah, yeah.
Not because
so
I thought we necessarily would convince each other at this moment.
So I should point out, when you said on the hook, when we talk about on the hook as in they are responsible for the criminal conduct of others, that's accomplice liability or conspiracy vis-a-vis Pinkerton. And for that, yeah, the norm, and also I think generally, you know, staff thinking was going to be a broad a more a, say, a broader standard, which is, say, easier to satisfy, so that in the situation you've given, you wouldn't be on the hook for vis-a-vis accomplice or conspiracy as a Pinkerton co-conspirator, right? But what we are talking about is a slightly different issue.
I'd be on the hook for solicitation.
Which is when what type of conduct? So we have to start from the base assumption that committing a criminal solicitation or committing a criminal conspiracy is justifiable, right? That's the sort of base assumption that general inquiry crime is culpable and is harmful, and even if even in an indirect sense. So then, starting from that assumption, the question becomes: what sorts of things that happen afterwards allow for this unique situation where we can kind of blot out the person's prior culpability? That's something we typically don't do, right? So, for example, like theft, if you take something and decide later on that you want to give it back, you've still committed theft. It's in this class of, or for example, if you have drugs and you're originally going to sell them, but then later on you decide against it, you're still on the hook for possession with intent to distribute. So the question then is, in this distinctive situation, what types of things that happen after the fact are we going to say, yeah, that this basically blots out the original blameworthiness culpability?
This is analogous to attempt, right?
This is analogous to attempt. The renunciation policies being recommended here would be applicable to attempt, conspiracy, and solicitation. Yeah.
And so the way it works with attempt, there's a trade-off. There is this moving up of the point at which a person can be guilty from attempt from the common law, right? But the attempt penalty is reduced.
Right.
And they add the incentive for a person to renounce fully via... So the shift from the common law, which was you're only guilty of attempt if you're right, if you're almost committing that crime, right? Right there on the cusp of committing the crime, then you're guilty. You're guilty of attempt, and the attempt carries pretty much the full charge in most common law jurisdictions. The reform jurisdictions move it back and lower the penalty and add the renunciation as a kind of cluster of reforms that are intended to encourage people to not even begin engaging in this type of behavior. To renounce it early on, but also to lower the penalty early on. What's interesting is that although the penalty is lowered for attempt in that reform movement, solicitation emerges as its own distinct penalty, and the penalty I don't think is dropping for solicitation, right? And so there's kind of like a little bit of a theoretical or movement mismatch that I think you're picking up on in the overall shift from common law jurisdictions to reform jurisdictions. Because DC is this weird amalgam of the two, although mostly tending towards common law, you have to figure out where you're going to land on those, on that. Does that make sense, or am I clouding the waters?
No, I think
that's actually helpful to hear.
I think, Laura, I think, you know, a good example of kind of like think through what's at stake here is to actually look at the attempt context. Let's say someone sets a bomb somewhere, it's on a timer, and then they decide after they've set it and the timer that, they want to cancel this app, it's a bad idea. They go to police, they tell the police where the bomb is, you know, how to defuse it, where the timer is. And the police get there, you know, a second too late, and the bomb goes off. Right? In that situation...
No, it's... Okay, fine. Go ahead.
No, so I guess the question there is, in that situation, whether or not the fact that the person didn't... That the harm still happened, you know, should renunciation... matter there, right? I mean, the fact that results happen, regardless of how, just tends to impact how people's intuitions work in terms of like whether or not someone's blameworthy and how blameworthy they are. So,
right, but I guess, well, yeah. I mean, I don't know. To me, that's an example. Well, I have two. I mean, whatever, we don't have to keep talking about
this. Yeah.
But quickly, I have two responses to that. One is, the reason the police didn't get there in time is because traffic in D.C. sucks,
right?
And people couldn't get out of the way in time for the cops to get, whatever, right? But honestly, I did everything. I really, 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 really tried.
Right.
And I made a substantial effort to prevent it.
Right.
And beyond my control. But it seems like before then, when I was going to stop you before, it seems like the bomb doesn't even have to go off. Because once it's set, the attempt is done. But even if the police get there in time, I haven't prevented the attempt.
No, but you would be...
Get out of the attempt, I had to call...
No, so renunciation defense would allow you to get out of the attempt by basically having prevented it from having occurred, right?
Oh,
so,
really?
So, yeah, so look at the language, right? So in prosecution for attempt, solicitation, or conspiracy,
uh-huh,
in which the target offense was not committed...
Oh, because it's the target offense.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So, yeah, so I'll just say this. There's a strong argument supporting the plurality minority approach, which is that in situations where a defendant's done everything they can do, particularly, let's say, like, for example, where police malfeasance, you know, or like you have an officer who just didn't move quick enough, and he could have, right? The intuition there is strongly that, like, why should that matter to a person's culpability? The counter is just that, A, the very possibility of renunciation itself in the first place is itself contested because the person has committed a crime. And then on top of that, the justification for renunciation is that there's just, like, if you look at a broader sort of, like, time span of the conduct, this later conduct can blot out, like, sort of the earlier blameworthiness of the original conduct, and that tend to be two things that go towards one's intuitions of blameworthiness. One is, like, state of mind, and definitely in the reasonable effort situation, the state of mind is there, the negating form of it. But the fact that the harm did occur is something that can impact, you know, how one sees that earlier conduct. So, yeah, that's what I would generally say about that.
Okay.
But I would, you know, I encourage you to submit some comments.
Yes, you've given me ideas. Great. Thank you.
Could anything else on renunciation, solicitation? If not, we'll move on to homicide. All right. Let me pull up homicide on the screen, so we have the language in front of us. And great. So, yeah. Various changes kind of obviously done at a macro level in grading, in incorporating the various penalty enhancements, which float, you know, out there separately. And again, kind of put out there the caveat that a lot's going on here. So really appreciate any input. And particularly, you know, like, where murder's an exception, right? And our practice for other offenses against persons of assault and robbery, you know, we've kind of included a standard set of the standard way that we've tried to incorporate separate free-floating penalty enhancements into the offense. The way we did that for assault and robbery with respect particularly to the wild armed enhancement, but also the kind of victim specific, is it a senior, is it a minor, all of that kind of standard treatment, you know, homicide may be different, and we're open to that argument. Certainly the focus on culpable mental states is different here, right? You know, and, a lot's been written about, you know, as a general matter in code revision, why, you know, codes are written with so much attention to culpable mental states in the context of murder and homicide, but not in other offenses, right? But that's the historic truth, right? Like, you know, the penalties are big, the stakes are big, and so these more attention to these finer ways of slicing up what was going on in the defendant's head really makes a even bigger difference. So, yeah. What thoughts or comments do you want to kind of raise to the group at this point?
So we had initially raised with you that what's happening by putting in the sort of a while armed enhancement as an aggravator for aggravated murder makes everything an aggravated murder. We still think that that's the case. But rather than addressing that you know, I shouldn't be part of an extensive list of things that creates aggravated murder, really, I don't think it makes any sense to create aggravated murder. And that because homicide is different, and because the mental states are different, and because of the way that you created aggravated murder, first-degree murder doesn't make as much sense anymore. What we would suggest is getting rid of aggravated murder altogether, sticking with two murders, first-degree and second-degree murder, like we have now, mm-hmm. and then having a sentencing enhancement or an aggravator that is, you know, that is different than writing it this way, that increases a penalty, even though it's different than assault. You can have a separate maximum sentence that increases because the individual is a juvenile without adding all these other, you know, public safety or participants in a citizen patrol, public safety employee, right? You can have a more narrow enhancement that increases a maximum, and that is not a separate homicide offense.
Gotcha. So, and I'm sorry, in just context for everybody too, we've had a conversation with them about this already. We're going to meet with Dave when he gets back from his vacation next week, and are happy to meet with anybody to kind of discuss these matters. So we've had some conversation about this before. Let me ask or check back too real quick though. Right. So your point is both kind of as a drafting matter and substantive, right? So, like, the drafting matter point would be like, well, instead of having a separate offense labeled aggravated murder, whatever the aggravators are, again, kind of keep them separate, just in its own thing. So we don't have a separate label for this thing called aggravated murder. And again, more akin to kind of like how it is now, we've got, you know, well, right now we've got two different lists of potential aggravators, and then we've got while armed, and then we've got, you know, the separate victim specific one, you know, so we've got multiple things floating out there right now, which affect the sentencing for first degree murder, second degree, you know, and on down for manslaughter. And so what you would recommend is keeping all of those separate, or some of those separate, or
keeping all of the enhancements, aggravators, whatever we want to call them, putting them all separate, putting them all in a single statute. And because it just the biggest problem, I think, apart from I don't think we should create a new offense of aggravated murder. I think first and second degree provide enough differentiation, but when you have a way of committing first degree is second degree murder plus one of these things, and reckless second degree murder doesn't make sense with most of these aggravators. And so you have a statute that becomes really hard to read and to follow and to indict, instead of having this, here's the mental state. The mental state made it this type of murder. And here's this extra penalty that comes from this other thing that also has to be proven to a jury, but it just makes much more rational sense.
We also propose substantive changes to which enhancements should apply. I wasn't sure if you mentioned, sort of, example, like district employees might not be included. We might have a separate enhancement for law enforcement officer or for an elderly person, but maybe some of these things will also fall out substantively.
Yes.
And it sounds like you might make finer grade distinctions with particular types of murder or homicide offenses, right? So like certain ones will only apply to first, not to second, or even to certain particular forms of second degree murder.
I don't know that.
So like depraved heart murder, you know, can be, you know, can't be enhanced on the same kinds of ways that we can enhance sort of other forms of murder, for example.
And that's probably true because it would not factually, some of these could not factually apply to depraved heart murder. We would recommend narrowing the list of individuals that would result in an enhancement, just because the homicide allows for, will allow no matter what for a very high sentence, and judicial discretion can differentiate between the vulnerability of victims insofar as that relates to the culpability of the defendant. And so that can also be really narrowed. The mutilation, desecration, there's a lot of these that have arguable meaning beyond what judicial discretion can account for, and have a real impact on prejudicing a trial on the merits if they are happening in the same proceeding. And so would be really be better or more appropriate for a sentencing argument made by the government that does not increase the statutory maximum. I think before we even get there, the first part is just to create some list of enhancements and not create a whole new offense.
But to centralize and have just one list. Again,
yes,
like right
yes.
now we've got like, we've got the wild arm, minor, senior, the one list
police
in the
officer.
Murder statute. We've got the Title 23, you know, separate list of,
so
streamline and maybe you would cross a bunch of those out, right, when they, not just compile them, but you might want to limit them or their applicability. Have them separate. And then with that, I'm also, hearing the procedural implications of this, right? So then it becomes that was something else that we'd address, right? Like, stripping out, like, if you do what we kind of pitched here in this first draft, then, right, you don't need that kind of second level at the sentencing hearing, decisions on these other aggravating factors because that was included in the initial verdict. Saying procedurally separate those out, and that is a useful, beneficial thing procedurally, right? Like,
yes.
That's
so I think that's a little bit different, because I don't think that it could really be separated out under Apprendi. I think a lot of these are jury.
Exactly.
They're not. What I'm saying is that some of these enhancements could fall away because they are really just considerations that are part of the judicial discretion that would happen in sentencing.
Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha.
Have you sort of jailed in your mind which ones those are?
I think that some of these are the ones that would not be admissible as Drew and Johnson evidence, and yet create the most potential for prejudice at a trial. So extreme physical pain and mental suffering, certainly a sentencing consideration, but you'd really have to have a bifurcated trial if that's an element of the offense, and the defendant is saying misidentification and the DNA on the weapon is someone else's, and yet there's going to be days of testimony about physical pain and suffering. So that would be appropriate within at sentencing, not increasing a maximum. Same with mutilation and desecration. I don't know that substantial planning or murder for hire, witness. You're with some of these, with the murder for hire, there are going to be two individuals charged presumably under two different theories. I don't know that needs to be singled out. It was sort of like it's a drive-by shooting versus not a drive-by shooting. You're thinking about it was that it doesn't really change the culpability or the harm that's caused. So for C, D, E, and F, even though E and F would probably be admissible as Drew Johnson evidence, I don't know that they really need to be enhancements. G would be separately charged also as obstruction of justice, which wouldn't run concurrent. I can't imagine a non-consecutive sentence where there's substantial obstruction of justice and a homicide. So, I mean, I think when we're trying to deal with overlapping, if that element is found beyond a reasonable doubt, that element is obstruction of justice.
Sure.
So why does that need to be there?
No, that's, and yeah, we haven't gotten for, Don, I don't know if you've been, the district's obstruction of justice statute, like several jurisdictions actually have this too. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it could use some help. It's this long, it's one of these laundry lists of like, you know, permutations with a catch-all at the end of varying degrees of severity. Like, obviously, the conduct ranges from, like, really, really horrific, like,
killing a witness
to the kind of lowest-level interference with the proceeding in a substantial way. So, right, we haven't gotten there. You're right, this, you know, definitely is an element or an aggravator here that potentially overlaps. So very sympathetic to addressing that, yes, somehow that overlap. And, you know. Well, good. So I don't know if there anybody else wants to chime in at this point. On kind of, you know, what PDS, what Katya's kind of described.
Can I just ask a question? And maybe this is already clarified in your back and forth there. So this would radically simplify the homicide portion other than the enhancements, right?
When you say this, do you mean what's written here or
what
Katya's
proposal? No, the proposal, right? Which I think is a big plus. And then could try to figure out the enhancements later on. So I think it's favorable for that reason. There are some things that trigger a move from one state to another that might not be aggravating circumstances, and I'm just wondering if basically what you're saying is simplify totally, with all get move all the aggravating stuff out and just have them be that way, or if there are certain things like homicide conducted but that occurs in the course of a listed felony that you would leave in.
I don't think that one's, I don't think of felony murder as an enhancement.
Okay.
So, yes, the felony murder stays,
but
everything else would be an enhancement, and then you judge how much to enhance. Maybe you don't enhance as much when it's second degree versus first degree, but...
That makes sense.
But you don't move between the murder boxes, you don't move unless... You know, it's a jury finding on a lesser included, but you don't statutorily. We don't have that where you can go up. I think our other big point is that premeditation and deliberation really matters, and I'm hoping that Renata can back me up on this one, because I think that while the case law has really evolved to say it's just this thought and this, you know, turning over, it's. I think that the way that we practice in Superior Court is that there has to be some additional thing that, you know, that the woman who cuts in line, and if there is that, you know, I'm really angry that that person cut in line, and at that point I take out a weapon and shoot that person.
I wasn't that close. Maybe you were.
I didn't care. Wow. This is a real insight into the workings of
I really didn't see that in Laura.
Okay. Okay. From now on, we'll look at Laura a little differently.
No, but okay, let's say I keep my hands on my side when I'm around you.
But that would not, you know, you pull out your gun, you shoot the
mine's mitigated. Like, if you had killed her, yours would have been totally cold-blooded. Okay. Go ahead.
We're not up to that.
Go ahead,
so you pull out your firearm, and you shoot, you pull out your dangerous weapon, you stab. That is not charged as first-degree murder. Is that correct? Yes. Even though it took some thought to take it out of your pants, out of your pocket, we don't charge. It's just not charged. It's not. That's not what's happening in Superior Court. So it really... it matters for this distinction, and it matters, you know, if we're aligning, you know, we're changing things, so we're not really trying to align the history of everyone who's been, you know, found guilty on these offenses over the course of years, but that's, getting rid of that is something meaningful, and it's a meaningful separator now between first and second degree. And I would say that, you know, many homicides have this element of rashness to them, where there's a dispute and then there's a weapon that is pulled. And for those many, many homicides that are not currently charged as first degree because of the lack of premeditation and deliberation, that the U.S. Attorney's Office conceives as something different, that practitioners conceive of as something different. Yeah. I think the court conceives of as something different when even thinking about probable cause and substantial probability. We're moving everybody up an offense.
Yeah, and I mean, part of the thinking there was that because that margin, though, notwithstanding the actual charge decisions, it's so subtle, it's such a small gap to get to premeditation, that something like substantial planning would be sort of like a much sort of a heavier center to meet to get to that. So we're still drawing this reform version, still drawing this distinction between the impulsive killing and a planned killing, something more like a really like. I think what a normal person would think of as premeditation is making that distinction. That's it, like the labeling sort of shifts around and changes, but that distinction is still, to some degree, we want to maintain that in the code. We just want to prevent the cases where do you just take 2 seconds to think about it before you whooped out the gun and shot the person in line, or do you spend 5 seconds and all of a sudden now it's being charged as premeditated first-degree murder, even though there really isn't a significant distinction between the two. But the point's certainly well taken, though.
And again, you know, I think, like, you know, right, you know, tons of case law on this, and I hear your point, which is, like, in practice, this has a very different utility and function in most cases than, yes, the very fine line that's drawn that, yeah, maybe that... there is some case law that waters down premeditation deliberation to these very, very, very slight things, but practically it does play a bigger role that we should preserve, and so that's kind of what I hear you saying, and that totally makes sense. That, you know, maybe, you know, right, and again, given that, you know, a significant portion of homicides are going to have, right, it's not the clear, you know, substantial planning, nor is it instant, you know, like instant reaction. How much do we want to parse that little difference between the 1 second, 5 seconds, a minute? A lot falls into that category, and so it matters a lot if there's a way to, if we're slicing that differently. So definitely appreciate that. And yeah, we're not already, anybody like has like thoughts on that. And like, you know, again, we want to very much, this is one where we want to really respect, you know, current practice and kind of fairness in a, you know, how it plays out. And we, you have much greater, you know, you have the expertise on this, so we really appreciate, you know, any feedback on this point. Yeah, so I don't know if there are other comments on this point. Good. Well, other aspects or you wanted to raise today, or anybody does, on homicide, you know, manslaughter too. Again, right? You know, manslaughter is nothing in the code right now, other than a line about the penalty.
Does your vision of the murder statute sort of translate also to the homicide? I mean, to the manslaughter statute. But the difference here being that even if you strip out aggravated and you strip out all of the aggravating factors, you're still left with more versions of manslaughter than currently exist.
Well, case law recognizes
that there's two offenses,
a distinction.
So we still have
two. But you're right. I mean, even codifying that is a significant step, right? Like, But yes, it was your per Don's question, yeah, right? Is your sense of like all the way down manslaughter and murder? We pull out the aggravators and have kind of a separate, again, both as a drafting matter, it pulls them out, and then there might be substantive changes as to like what applies. That you know, I'm sure there might be more, like you're saying. You know, some of these just don't apply for like manslaughter, you know, that kind of, or if you could prove that aggravator, you could prove murder, right? You know, so anyway.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think because they don't so much make sense with the mental states that you need for manslaughter, it also makes sense to pull them out. Once you pull them out of homicide, to keep the consistency with lesser included, even if you have a statute that says these are all lesser included of the others, it just doesn't. Trying to think about it from like a jury sitting there, like you didn't have it. I guess they would have the aggravators as a separate box to check if the sentencing enhancement was indicted, and so it wouldn't look crazy to a jury that suddenly you have these other new elements when you're looking at the lesser included. Yes, but for clarity, it would make sense to pull them all out from both. What proportionality would having it 3 degrees of manslaughter versus 2 add?
Yeah, unclear, right? I will say, you know, when we were thinking about this too, you know, one thought was like, well, does the, you know, we haven't gamed that out in terms of like, okay, we have, you know, this number of classes, and so how are these kind of, you know, being treated? You know, it is, you know, you could have overlap, right? Such that like aggravated manslaughter is penalized the same as regular second degree murder, right? Like if you have 3 degrees,
right?
I'm using hand gestures here. You know, right? You know, you could have that. You could have, you know, potentially there's even some like, you know, it's in between. Or it's below, you know, different permutations. We don't have anything set in mind about that. Again, we just kind of wanted to initially kind of like figure out where the main gradations are. Again, kind of pushing off kind of what particular numbers are tied to them. Obviously, that's a concern. And obviously, you know, look, some of this like, right. You know, this raises questions, you know, we have a big, chunky 30-year mandatory minimum.
Just a second, I think that probably means Paul dropped off.
Paul, are you on the call still? Let me keep that on in case he, like, dropped out and calls back in.
I've been sitting here all day.
Brief musical interlude. It's kind of hilarious. It is 11 o'clock, too. A little cookie break for a minute. Let me try to turn that down.
Sorry, you parked the cookies down.
No, exactly. You know, Don should pass them back up there. All right, I'll try to listen and see if Paul is able to get back in right now. Right.
that it meaningfully criminalizes conduct that the other two don't? Like, is there space for three in
Sorry.
Terms of the
yeah.
conduct?
In terms of the penalties,
I mean,
yeah.
I mean, so like one of the examples, you know, like commit, you know, knowingly kill someone under heat of passion, but that person's like a kid or something. Like arguably, that should be penalized worse than if I personally kill a 30-year-old in the heat of passion. You know, or not. Again, I think you've raised concerns about whether all of these aggravators or enhancements really should apply in all the cases. And so, like, maybe if you kill someone in the heat of passion, the age of the person just doesn't matter. Or, so, you know, intuition of these, you know, can certainly vary. But I think it was, like, generally speaking, those kinds of crimes, given sort of status of the deceased, could warrant higher, greater punishment.
That's just one general challenge that the aggravators present, and this goes and sentencing enhancements as well, is like what things materially increase the harm or culpability, and to the point where it needs to create a new ceiling for statutory maxima, and then if those things do they do so equally across offenses, whether from, you know, assault or homicide or whatever. And, you know, there's no precise way to answer that, but at least one thing that's helpful that this conversation does, you know, is worth being conscious about that. You know, whereas we have these sentencing enhancements in general provisions, you know, in DC code, where things never, you know, they seem to have not been taken as seriously, but they always loom out there. And so, you know, the question is, should we have them? And if so, we should be, you know, should we be transparent about it or not?
Yeah, I will say too, like, looking forward to sentencing, like, you know, as we have no, you know, at the top, it flattens out, right? Like, you know, and same thing at the bottom, right? You know, like, the most severe and the least severe, they can kind of get pinched at both ends, right? And, you know, it just get, you know, particularly for murder, right? Like, murder is the most serious offense. Doesn't get much worse than killing people. How much, you know, any of these things, they kind of get washed out. These other aggravating factors get more or less washed out when you already have a lifetime, you know, penalty for that offense. So, you know, and, it, you know, there are arguments. There are a lot of arguments for why you should still have that, right? You know, you know, having a 100-year sentence, right, available versus a 80 years. You know, either way, you know, there might be other reasons for having that, but you could also say, like, look, again, once you've proven something that has an effective lifetime sentence, and that is available on the table. We don't need to, like, layer on top a bunch of other things that go life, essentially a lifetime plus. And that's, you know, again, there's only so, we're at the limit of how much you can punish somebody, at least in this jurisdiction, when you get to, like, a lifetime sentence, right? So what do you do with that? It just, it's a problem at the top, right? And you're pushing up against the ceiling with these offenses. You know, they're kind of unique kind of problems too at the bottom. So, right. All this is to say murder's different. Maybe all of homicide is different, but certainly murder is kind of different than all other offenses in how these aggravators apply. We, again, so we're, I apologize, you know, we haven't completed yet getting out the statistics that we have on kind of some of this. We're continue to find some quirks in the data that we have received that we're trying to sort through and make it accessible with some consistent, coherent, you know, charge descriptions. So anyway, we're still working on that, and we'll hopefully have some to share on, like, again, what enhancements are being actually used. It seems like it's relatively few. Right, for any of these aggravators. Senior, minor, yes. You know, while armed is charged, you know, frequently with this. Beyond that, not much, right?
Will you have that before the deadline?
No, not in the next week and a half. I'm sorry, yeah. And I mean, and I will say, like, but like all your points are, like, frankly, they stand regardless, right? And I think, you know, all the counterpoints kind of stand regardless. Like, even if it isn't being used, the availability of it in the, that unique case for, you know, we don't have, you know, that much murder for hire, but having that on there is, you know. So I don't think the statistics will be by any means dispositive on this point. But yeah, I think they will end up or might end up kind of lending support at least as to how current practice, you know, functions on this. So we will get that as soon as we can. Other thoughts or questions at this point? Again, you know, happy to meet with anybody individually about questions, either just like, you know, don't understand the meaning of this, you know, can you explain this more? Or, you know, to talk through, like, other possibilities. I mean, again, we're very much open to that. But if there's nothing else on homicide, I would check in then also on child neglect and abuse and abuse and neglect of vulnerable adults. And I'm sorry, I did get a follow-up message from Paul that he needed to step out for something. So there's that. We don't have to listen to the muzak anymore. So, good. Anything else homicide related?
I would just say that I think that the PDS's proposal maps on to a fairly standard understanding of homicide, which is divided into voluntary and involuntary, and that you have first-degree murder, which is premeditated, which then is reduced to second-degree murder, where there's enough impulsivity, which is reduced to voluntary manslaughter, which is with sufficient provocation. And so that conceptual framework on the voluntary side, I'm just trying to figure out how aggravated would fit in there. And just in terms of the conceptual map that most people carry about voluntary homicide, that it might interfere with that kind of existing mental map that people are really can parse once they kind of get the hang of it pretty intuitively.
What's the premeditation point? Like the MPC and the majority of the reform jurisdictions have also dropped the premeditation distinction, it's been a long-standing model going back to, I think, late 1700s in the U.S. or early 1800s. So.
And yeah, there's a number of other jurisdictions, not so much kind of, you know, MPC-based reform jurisdictions,
still retain right, that distinction between first and second degree murder.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, all this obviously is like deep support in case law and very thoughtful, you know. So, well, we will, welcome any comments on these points. Digging deeper, also, like if anybody wants to kind of like, you know, pinpoint particular enhancements, right, that like should stay or go, you know, why that should be the case, that'd be great. And I, the last thing I kind of say, unless there's other comments on homicide, is just like, right, this is kind of one of our, you know, the most important offenses, right, and it needs the most, one of the most amounts of work. And so there will be a second draft. we'll do our best to kind of tweak things and fundamentally restructure. I don't mean to as needed. So, and again, particularly I welcome any like kind of practice, you know, insights, right? Like on how this goes down, because again, we are largely basing off of, you know, current law, right? And case law on this, some of these points, might be very different than how things play out in practice. So getting, you know, formal comments or informal, just give me a call, you know, it's all helpful.
I already pointed out, I think it's worthwhile for our homicide sections to, as we're pulling over this, to get together to see where we have some common ground.
All right, well, if there's nothing else at this point, then child neglect, abuse, vulnerable adult neglect and abuse. Were there any comments or questions there? Again, we kind of flagged some issues in the memorandum, and in particular, this is not specific to child abuse, but it definitely, like, we agonized over this kind of more here than previously, which is, you know, the parental discipline exception in general. How and in what ways does can minors give consent to anything, right? These are questions that are not well well defined anywhere, right? Like, very few jurisdictions do this clearly by statute. And I think because it's a very hairy issue, and there's like a lot of like distinctions between when, for like, to kind of categorically say a 17-year-old cannot consent to, you know, to a simple assault versus a felony assault. How about, you know, any assault when their parent has already said, you will not engage in these activities, and has told that other person you will not.
An example? Because my 12-year-old was outraged, and my 14-year-old was finally like, just shut up, I don't care, you're being annoying. And I was like, everybody stop talking in the car. But the 12-year-old's friend got a splinter, and the school, the nurse isn't allowed to take it out. And somehow somebody had a needle, which, like, I don't even know. And they and my 12-year-old was like, can you believe I wasn't allowed to, like, take a needle to my friend's finger to take the splinter out? And I was like, well, sweetie, I'm like, yeah, that's potentially dangerous. Just like, they don't let you stab your friend with a sharp, but, like, that's crazy. And I was like, well. But I said, well, this is interesting. I bet this comes up today where there's a struggle. Like, can one 12-year-old say to another, yeah, help me with this splinter, right?
Because
that's a bodily injury.
That happened to my daughter, who got it in her thigh. And the nurse just sat there doing nothing. And luckily for her, one of her friends pulled it out. And then we took her to a long story short, like a year later, a piece of that vein still worked its way out of her. But... so there's some time when common sense might prevail. Yeah. But anyway, so I get.
But that was a pullout as opposed to, like,
sorry,
let me take a sharp.
No.
So I don't, you know, but it is this. I sort of was like, well, what if something went wrong? Doesn't her parent say to the school, how
why
on earth are you letting another 12-year-old do surgery or whatever, right? Like,
yeah,
what is the. But it sort of struck me as a sort of a, like, that is potentially bodily injury.
Yep.
If, you know,
yep,
can the one consent to the other? And I. So it's not necessarily sports or let's fight after school. Like, it was a relatively, like, benign thing that I was, in the context of thinking about this, I hadn't thought of that kind of example of how it could be something that everyone sort of says, that's kind of a good thing. I'm not sure whether we let children consent to that or not, but at least.
But do you think that's reckless? I don't even think that's reckless. I'd be negligently causing any injury that happens from that. I'd be negligent, right?
Use of the needle into someone else's body would be bodily injury.
Or what about, like, an ear piercing or a tattoo or something?
There you go.
Then it's just purposeful. And.
But the intent is not to harm the child. In fact, the intent is to...
Wait, I can't remember how did we write it?
Yeah. So part of this is, like, again, basically current child abuse... and the revised version.
But you said that there, but in this jurisdiction, we do have guidance on parental discipline, right? It's
we do. We do. It exists. Yeah. It's more a question of, again, like, on that point, like, we didn't address that in assault, for instance, right? And, you know, okay, well, we need to, So we did hear, but we're, you know, in this process, we were also like, it needs to be applied because essentially child abuse here is like, it's assaultive conduct. What we kind of normally think of as assaultive conduct with its, you know, different gradations, you can kind of cognize it that way. Plus some other stuff, right? Like, you know, and this is like, we have this case law.
But the assaultive conduct will suffice. It's just, it covers other
stuff. And we have this additional scope of liability for child abuse. So all the kind of stuff, when we start to talk about kind of effective consent to an assault by another, and what about, you know, a parent's use of some degree of, you know, force or restraint or something, you know, like, anyway, all this is at play in assault and in child abuse. And again, jurisdictions don't clearly don't handle this well. That is to say, like, their code doesn't, they tend to have very piecemeal, when it comes up, and because again, prosecutorial discretion is used to avoid applying these in, typically in borderline or unreasonable cases, but occasionally you see these cases come up and then they deal with it through case law in other jurisdictions on a case-by-case basis. But we don't, there isn't like kind of good, like clear language up front. And it's the kind of thing like we also hit, you know, so, you know, working on kidnapping now. Okay, well, yeah, you know, that there's another place where, we have a separately recognized parental kidnapping statute. Okay, well, that's a certain type of conduct, but, you know, we're entertaining all sorts of hypos where it's, you know, again, parent has clearly said to 17-year-old, you know, you can't go to, you know, person X's house, and person X, you know, says, you know, I think your home is, you know, not a good place for you to stay tonight for whatever reason, right? Like, in, out of a beneficent intent, in, you know, now we're already in enticing, you know, land, right, under the current kidnapping statute. You know, if they go over, you know, like, well, what liability attaches? Do we think a 17-year-old should be able to countermand their parents', you know, directive to go someplace?
I'm just looking at the learning process of 17.
You know, and again,
what age is?
Let me tell you what was really upsetting to my husband and to me. The twins turned 18 at the end of February, at their school. They came home with these forms. They said, "Oh, we turned 18, so now we sign these things." Like, as if
we'll
the school
let you know
was giving them, and I was like,
"That's
no,
interesting.
I guess situation bills coming to you as well."
I'm paying the tuition.
Exactly. Give them the tuition bill too. Then.
Yeah.
Your
See
choice.
What you get then.
Your choice.
Oh my God.
So
that's why I looked at you. I figured you might
so,
have feelings.
So this is the thing, right? Like, you know, anyway, and all this, right? It's around the art of, you know. We have the artificial, you know, 18 is a magic number in a lot of ways, legally, and yet practically it isn't. And we are gradations here. And again, like, how do we recognize that? Again, particularly for, like, at the high end with a 17-year-old and the amount of autonomy they should have over their body to go get an ear piercing without their parents' permission or to, you know, stay someplace. And that does seem different, and the liability you hold whatever the person is at the mall who's, you know, piercing the ear, or the other parent or the friend, versus a 9-year-old or 5, right? Like, I think intuitions are different about these things in terms of what is normally kind of acceptable and how much we can deal with this. The danger, part of the struggle we have is also like, is even to punt on this. Like, it's hard, you know, once you codify it out, right? Like, you know, it's hard to even say that, like, we're not exactly, you know, like, the plain language either incorporates, you know, minors and kind of, like, puts them on one side of the line or the other in terms of whether their consent is effective or not. And so we can't, you know, it's even hard to see how we would write this in a way that it's gray and isn't clearly from its plain language pointing one way. So it's something that we're struggling with. the child abuse really raised this again, and you know, Rachel's gone through this both with assault and now child abuse again. So we're working at it. It's a work in progress. I will say again, very few jurisdictions even tackle this in their codes. And then there's usually just a lot of case law handling the quirks that come up. So even if we wanted to kind of punt a bit on specifying when a minor's consent is or is not effective for relieving liability, even figuring out how to do that is like tricky, because we don't want to blanket get rid of it. We don't want to blanket include it. So that is a challenge that's front and center. Just wanted to flag in the child neglect, child abuse, because again, it's essentially, you know, from the way we've restructured and, you know, kind of put it on the board again, you know, we're trying to make it consistent with the assault, you know, distinctions, right? You know, serious, and to some extent that's already there in current law. To some extent there's the current child abuse statute is very broad language, but it sometimes it references serious bodily injury. It also makes clear that perhaps any bodily injury, like a simple assault level, also counts. There's also broad language about causing psychological harm, which is kind of undefined, but a potentially very big deal, right? Like, you know, once you open the door, what degree of psychological harm? What does that mean? You know, obviously there are many ways in which we typically, criminal law does not address causing psychological harm to people, except with, you know, some stalking type behavior where it's only harassment, you know, there isn't actual threat. So there are times when the criminal law is only recently and only in these kinds of contexts dabbled a bit in these areas. And when it does, honestly, again, it hasn't done it with great clarity. And yet it's a potentially very tricky point. So we come up with a definition of serious mental injury that we pitch based, you know, case law. You know, we've done our best to put something in there. So, now I don't know what else to say. I think this is a place too where, and you know, Dave's not here, but you know, while this is the criminal offense, it's a felony offense. It's not an OAG prosecutorial offense. It has a lot of implications for a whole civil system that, you know, that this is out there. And I made mention to Dave about this, and so like, you know, I mean, I mean, some initial outreach, anyway, whatever we come up with here on the criminal side, it would be, I think, useful and helpful to get a sense from the civil side folks about whether this is kind of significantly affecting what they do.
Does that definition loop in the criminal law? Abuse and neglected child, it doesn't. I feel like there's a statutory definition that's...
They have distinct... We're not copying over some of their... They have a different set of definitions in Title 16, wherever it is, We reference it simply... Like, they have their own distinct definitions that we're not... Because they go much lower, right? Obviously, and they should, right, to deal with more... They're trying to, you know, they're in a preventive mode and they need to take into account different variables. So I don't think anything we do, you know, because again, you know, like we put serious mental injury there. That's already recognized. Something like this with less specificity is recognized in district case law. So it's not like, I don't think this is making a huge shift.
Can I ask a question, having now just reread to focus a little bit more on the definition of serious mental injury and wondering how it works? Mm-hmm. If I don't give my child
medication, right? So I have an omission. I don't give my child whatever medication I, because I'm, whatever, I was going to say because I was worried about side effects, but that maybe it's not even that rational. And therefore, you know, it's medication for anxiety, it's medication for depression. What is that? How does that fit in? How am I not criminally
liable? Yeah. So you are potentially, so the basic, you know, distinction of criminal, it's restructured such that child...
Yes, abuse is limited to actual injury or the use of physical force, whereas neglect is essentially just risk. So if you look at the child neglect statute, depending on the, obviously, causation and mental state and what type of injury is risked or not, it could be first degree, second degree child neglect. Could also potentially be third degree, which is just failing to make a reasonable effort to provide.
I guess what I'm asking is, because it strikes me that this might be abuse and it's just kind of a weird thing. So when I was reading the definition, I at first sort of thought, and which is why I then turned to it, sort of like, I've got a kid who's depressed. Mm-hmm. I haven't caused the depression. They are depressed. What I have done is, on purpose... After the doctor says, here is a pill, this will help. And I say, I'm not doing it. Which, right? So we've defined, can't remember, actions to include omissions or something. Have I ended up? I imagine this isn't what any of us intends. Or maybe at some level it is. I don't know.
I think it may be. I think under current case law, it may be.
First degree child abuse.
Potentially. I mean, again, so here's the thing.
Yeah, based on the facts. I mean, you have a causation problem, I think, a challenge in these hypos.
Well, so right. So
well, I'm not sure you would have a causation problem. Yeah. I mean, the facts really depend. So, like, in kind of like a far-fetched hypothetical where whatever the psychological trauma the kid is suffering from has an easy fix, just take this one pill and... You know,
so we know
it. Real depression typically isn't that.
Well, right. Anxiety, whatever, something.
You take this pill. The child has an infection. With modern medicine, we know if you take this particular antibiotic, you will be cured. The parent withholds it.
Right.
So that's an easy one without all.
Right.
So if psychological harms were as clear cut as in the case of antibiotics, then potentially, again, depending on the specifics of the facts. Yes, I think it's the hypo seems odd to you.
But maybe we've had the pill, we've taken it, and it's so and she's better. We know,
okay.
and then I say, this is really expensive, and we could use the money on something else.
Yeah,
I do think that depending on the circumstances, if it reaches into some kind of actual physical or mental harm, that could definitely be abuse, and it almost certainly would be under current law, I imagine.
Really?
Yeah.
There's very broad language in the cases about, it's a pretty high bar, but the court reads into maltreats, significant psychological injury. But anxiety and depression also have very real physical manifestations, so you might not even have to go to serious mental injury. Your child could be having any other number of potentially like very physical symptoms as a result of not having proper medication that might solve the issue.
But is the thing that's going to allow me to win on that is, it's not like the pills are sitting there and I'm like, I'm like saying, I lost my job, I lost my insurance, I know there's a pill out there that helps you. The doctor's prescribed it, I'm not filling it.
Well, that sounds like a mental state issue.
No, so there's just, I think there's
two ways. So then I'm going to win on purpose. That's not... I'm not purposely, even recklessly, not to give it to you.
If you don't, so first degree child abuse is out because of purposely.
Why?
In your hypo, like if you are not purposely withholding.
I'm not doing it to.
Your
I'm not
conscious
intending
object
to,
is not to cause it.
I just
injury.
Am just. I'm that's consciously right. not.
So if first degree is out, then that would go. I imagine.
So
to
then
the
I'm maybe in
second degree,
okay.
Where the reckless does have that inherent calculation of. Substantial and unjustifiable, and I'm sure Michael can speak to that, but if it truly is a financial matter, that is a lot different than just like forgetting or something along those lines. And then there are, as Michael just said, justification, defenses, and things like that that would come into play. So it really isn't meant to
That's just like a common law thing. That's not, because I was
right.
here.
That's okay. right. No, a general. Okay. A general.
But
right,
so but that right. is a very different case. If you are not able to do what you want to do and need to do, that is a much different instance than the initial hypo, which is like, I'm just not going to do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very much so. And that's why I think down the road having these justification defenses codified would be very helpful, because it does come up even in the language we've put forward for like consent and assault and the parental discipline defense. We do always have that intro caveat of, in addition to any defenses otherwise applicable to the defendant's conduct. So there are these general justification things floating around out there in case law that would be on point to that hypo, it sounds okay. like.
Yeah, so another piece I would just say is that for an omission has to be voluntary. And what makes an omission voluntary is that you're physically capable of performing it. So there are just multiple, there are multiple like points in which questions would be raised. If someone can't afford it, then it's, you know, it's a question as to whether they're physically capable of providing it. There's also the question of like,
let's say you were going to use the money for Disney World.
Right. So that goes. So that goes more to that goes more to the recklessness. If you're proceeding under a reckless prosecution,
I have a cure to depression. It's Disney World, not this medication.
Right. So then that goes to justifiability, which is a question. And then, you know, so there's one other piece, which is you only have omissions only matter when you have a duty to where like there's a duty imposed, and so there's a question about how you conceptualize the scope of a duty. Does it, you know, presumably a parent's duty is to provide reasonable care, right? And so there's also another, just another place where you can conceptualize the issue is like whether or not, you know, let's, you know, for example, if the medication was $1 billion or whatever, you know, I mean, there questions arise too as to whether or not that even fell within the scope of the duty.
Okay.
Yeah. So child neglect in particular, like, and again, there are the revised version, specifically requires that the person knows that they have a duty of care to the child and, in fact, you know, violate that duty of care. So apart from, like, whether you, the element of whether you're creating a risk, you know, of something through the neglectful behavior, you have to know you have a duty of care to this person, right? Yeah. Now, the other kind of big picture thing, maybe just a flag, I don't know, is again, and we mentioned this in the memo, is kind of how this overlays with assault. So right now, assault, and you have always the minor enhancement for, you know, assault of conduct that bumps up 50%. Well, so for just for an assault plus a minor victim enhancement, that's really not different than most, again, we have this mental type of injury, but for other physical injuries, we're doing the same thing in a child abuse statute. It's duplicative. It's duplicative in current law. The same harm to a child could be, again, treated or charged both as child abuse or an assault.
Although
with
just,
a minor enhancement.
Just to flag too, like there is overlap and we are aware of that and we are going to address it, but the child abuse statute, the revised one, is more narrow than current law because we have imposed a requirement that the person is an adult at least 2 years older than the child, or the person is a parent, legal guardian, or other person in loco parentis, basically. So it is, like, there is overlap under current law, there is overlap in the revised code, but it's we have narrowed the scope of child abuse, in a sense, and limited the overlap to some extent, but it's still on a macro level very much there.
So, and this was, you know, this was kind of flat, you know, the commentary notes this is a change in law. In some respects, for instance, you know, there was a case of, you know, carjacking person who
has like three unrelated children in the back car, in the back seat of the car, and those children are then injured in the resulting car accident, and that is child cruelty under current district law, and under ours, it would not be child abuse. It might be something
you'd have
else.
Assault liability.
Assault
right?
liability, or down the road too, we're thinking about having a general reckless endangerment. Because really, if I were in the back of a car that was carjacked and I was injured, like just because I'm not a child, like that's also not good. And we've definitely talked about reckless endangerment in other contexts too, like arson, and so that's kind of also out there. What to do with that hypo.
But why does that hypo not mean child abuse? What's
under current law it is, but under ours
right.
it's not.
Why?
If it's just a random defendant.
Not related.
Well, it could be the person is an adult at least 2 years older. It depends on the ages, but it's not, definitely wouldn't be parent, legal guardian, or
right.
parentis. So it could be age-based. I don't know what the facts were that specifically in the case.
Right.
But yes, it could be child abuse if it was...
9-year-olds in the back and an 18-year-old who takes
no,
the
yes,
car.
I'm assuming
yeah.
so.
It'd be
okay.
kidnapping. It'd be a lot of other things.
Okay, I was just
point.
Trying
but if it was
to...
A group
no,
abuse,
you're right. I misspoke. It's, it would
okay.
be...
Unrelated foreign-related use. Or 18-year-olds.
Yeah, that...
Or 17
okay,
right?
okay,
yeah.
okay.
So,
okay.
But
I get it.
These issues, like everything we've described, is in play, right? Like, so the overlap issue... We could, because one thing we had talked about when where Rachel was going was like, you know, right, just blanket saying this doesn't apply for, you know, anybody other than, essentially, again, somebody with the duty of care to that child. Now, in part, this is about signaling, right? Or, you know, like, it's the labels that are getting used, right? We're not trying to, like, at least as to physical injuries... You can do the same thing in assault as you can do in child abuse. What label's being applied? And it does seem that that label carries a lot of weight, right? Like child abuse, you know, who should that be applied to? Should it be applied to a complete stranger in a carjacking situation? Well, should it be applied to a non-parent who's a daycare, right, provider? Who kind of, you know, whatever exceeds their authority and, you know, or should it be limited to kind of parental care? Different ways of handling this. Again, right now, everything gets kind of swept in with child, there's complete overlap with child abuse and assault. We've narrowed it.
But there's not complete overlap because you could get charged for both.
Yes, you're, that, I'm sorry, yeah, that's what I mean to say, right, is right now you can get charged with both, and, you know, that's right. Depending on the precise form and how, you know, they cognize the elements, I don't know whether it would pass kind of a elements test for merger.
Can I ask how this gets charged typically? Is it that child abuse and elder abuse are typically charged at caregivers, and then assaults are for people for who do not know or are not in some specific relationship of responsibility to the victim?
Yeah, I was just thinking through that. It's funny that you asked, because I think I actually drafted the brief in the Florence appeal. And my recollection, which I was trying to figure out, is that the parent was charged both with simple assault and cruelty to children. So I was thinking through the implications of our charging practice.
Yeah. And I will say, like, again, right now the current child cruelty, it's just written very differently. Like, it kind of makes sense. So that even though practically it includes assaultive conduct, even with the jury instruction, like, it makes sense to charge it both ways because it's going to sound very different. You know, the elements look different, right? And so in a revised code where we're in a world where, okay, it's clearer now that, like, yeah, all that kind of funky language that's in there for child abuse, it means an assault. As we've also, you know, these are in lockstep over here, plus some other stuff, right? Plus this kind of, in that world, you know, maybe you would approach it differently.
And I was also wondering when I go back and look at it from this perspective, whether I would find that it was charged that way when the child was older versus when you have a 5 or 6 year old.
That's
when
why
we get to 16 and 17 year olds. I'm
just curious. Yeah.
Like we were thinking, the case where you have an 18-year-old student in high school gets into a fist fight with a 17-year-old, should that 17-year-old then be, is the 18-year-old going to be a child abuse? Like that, the label seems disproportionate. And so we try to at least hem that in a little bit so you wouldn't have that result as you presumably would under current law.
So, you know, we, again, welcome comments on this. We did a, working within the basic contours of, like, you know, the scope of the laws aren't really, we don't think changed much. We tried to really systematize these and make them a lot clearer. And in that sense, they have changed a lot.
Oh, yeah.
So,
because, like, the child cruelty statute, the fact that it's called child cruelty, and it uses language like tortures, beats, maltreats, cruelly mistreats. It's very, it does look a lot different than what an assault, revised assault statute would look like.
So it's like knowingly, recklessly tortures, beats, or otherwise willfully maltreats a child under 18 years of age.
Yeah, and right now, you know, that willfully maltreats, the maltreats has been discussed in case law as a very broad thing, and I think that's
where
the
mental injury
comes in.
Right.
And so,
although it says and thereby causes bodily injury,
it's a very low standard for. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's been taken to well.
Which is why there would be a distinction between the antibiotic case and the mental illness case under this the current.
Yeah. So on the screen is the, for everybody else who wants to see, the current statute. You know, again, yeah, and second degree has just a straight maltreats. You know, first degree has willfully maltreats, as if it's, these are different ways. Tortures or beats. You know, beats, okay, well, anyway,
when was this drafted?
This is old.
And then otherwise willfully.
The majority of this, I believe, is from an 1885 statute, and then the mental states and the bodily injury, that was added in I think, 2000-something. But the core of it and a lot of that language is from the 1880s.
Now, they did get rid of, didn't they have, I think at some point, this is where they, like in the 90s, excised really old language, which is like forced to join a, do you remember this? It was like forced to join a circus kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
there was.
Like, no, I kid you not, right? It was like serious old school 19th century.
Well, they got rid of one really old statute.
Well, it's funny because I was thinking of this in the context of a 17-year-old who decides not to run away with the circus, but to run away with something we may consider a cult where there's like some sort of corporal component.
Yeah. Yeah, we've the cold examples actually come up in some of our discussions again, it's this, it's voluntary. It is arguably, from the defendant's point of view, for a beneficent, you know, it isn't motivated from ill will. I'm not trying to purposefully maltreat. I think I'm helping. You know, the cult leader might genuinely believe. And yet, it comes up with kidnapping, you know, in particular, where it's just locating, relocating, you know, not no assault, no psychological harm, and at least in a kind of way that we normally think. But they've chosen to go somewhere. Like, anyways, so we're trying to be sensitive to these issues. It's a whole set of hypotheticals. These cases don't get charged often, right? So, and again, for most of the assault with an enhancement for the victim being a minor is kind of always available and can do a lot of work in the physical assault case. So we're also trying to like be cognizant of the overlap and like, okay, well, what added stuff does this need to do for child? Like, again, vulnerable adults is an even different set of issues where, again, vulnerable adults as defined does not mean incompetent, and that's a really important distinction, right? Like,
you know? And so, again, now you've got a person, right, who is competent, is, you know, of age, and basically their consent, you know, shouldn't be treated differently than any other person because of their disability, right? And now this can play out in different ways in different cases, right? Like,
well, right, so. Because it plays out very differently in where there's some sort of physical abuse as it does where there is an economic crime.
Right. So we have this, if y'all remember, we have the special financial exploitation of a vulnerable adult, which was really trying to, like, hit some of these.
Misses the mark terribly because it's an issue of proof. The person rarely is overcome.
That's right.
And they love their niece. And so when they come to them, they give them the money. But what actually should be important there is the mental state of that person who knows that they are doing something that is in the that is adverse to the financial interest of the victim.
But these are all very hard things to they're very hard to codify and very hard to and be really clear about because you know fraud often gets at these schemes, but not always. You know, again, so.
We're on the record.
We'll be off the record shortly.
we should, though, be mindful. I mean, Dave will be important here. Because it's actually, I think their child abuse statute is in Title 13. But the reason I was thinking Title 4 is because that's where the definitions are. And you were thinking Title 16 because undoubtedly there's some more stuff in there. And because very often, you know, one group or another will argue, well, you can extrapolate from this definition over here with this. We should probably just be mindful and careful about what we intend to do or not.
That's right. That's right. And yeah, we will be meeting separately with Dave and want to talk about some of these before they get their comments. Anything else? Otherwise, wrap up. There's a few cookies left if anybody's interested. Comments due again, kind of the end of next week, the 11th. And yep, appreciate everybody's time and input and. Let me know again if you're like already planning summer vacations and know you'll miss like the August meeting, for instance, or you know upcoming meetings. We lose critical mass, we'll just cancel it. We lose a person or two, we may go ahead and. So. Thank you all.
Great, thank you.
Supporting.
We're on.